Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Carl.
Hello.
And I'm Josh. So we're going to be talking about the limitations of science. And this isn't necessarily science, the methodology, because I think the actual methodological side of things, it's difficult to dispute that observing things multiple times means that it's more likely to be true. I think that's how most people think about how you discover truth in the world, but we'll talk about that more. It's more so science as an industry, as an academic discipline. It's that side of things. So I'm going to be talking about the ways in which it is imperfect and hopefully proposing ways in which it can improve, although sometimes the problems that face science are pretty irreconcilable with any solution that I've been able to come up with. But without further ado, I think it's worth mentioning scientific bias, because this is perhaps the most obvious route where science can go wrong. And this is, of course, not the methodology, as I said before, just to clarify, because I might get people saying, oh, you're being anti-science as a principle.
As a principle.
You're not really.
I am really. I'll explain.
I don't believe you.
I'll explain as we go through.
But one of the one of the most obvious aspects of how science is limited is that all scientists bring their own preconceptions and biases to their research projects. And this is something that's unavoidable. It's part of being a human being, is that you have predispositions in your thoughts about the world. And quite often when you approach a question or new evidence or many different things, you bring these ideas that shape the nature of your subsequent inquiry. And this is something that everyone does. It's impossible to avoid it, because you can't be perfectly objective. You've always got some sort of subjective influence on your thoughts and behavior.
But there's a problem that, in fact, our biases shape our perceptions of the world as well. Thomas Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn made a great observation about the movement of the heavens. In Western doctrine, it was assumed that the heavens were static, and so we didn't notice that the heavens moved for hundreds and hundreds of years, whereas in China, they didn't have this doctrine. And so they knew for thousands of years that the stars moved around us. Mm-hmm. And this was always the case. We could always have looked up and seen it, but because of a sort of doctrinal bias that Catholicism had imbued in Western culture, we failed to make that observation when people who weren't Catholic and didn't have that doctrine actually were able to see it very easily. Mm. And so this is actually a kind of alarming level of bias, isn't it? Like how it's, yeah. your like what you have observed is changed by your bias. And so that really casts doubt on a human being's ability to actually do science as science claims it should be done.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm actually in quite an interesting position to be evaluating this, because studying psychology, you learn lots of the limitations of human perception. And there are lots of things like inattentional bias, whereby there's a famous experiment, I think it's by Simons, and it was in the early 2000s, where they got people to pass a basketball between a group of people.
And the gorilla walks through.
Yes.
Yes.
But if you tell people to count the basketball passes,
no one notices the gorilla.
Yeah. It's a person in a gorilla suit, walks right into the middle of the circle, beats their chest and walks out of frame again. And you think, surely I'd be able to see that. But when your attention is diverted to something else, it's impossible to know. And there are lots of limitations to human perception that are problems for finding out the truth. But I think the solution from the scientific world is that one research paper isn't worth very much, because the effect of the bias itself is going to be most prevalent there. But if you accumulate the knowledge acquired from multiple research papers, it's almost like cancelling out the noise in your data. It can compensate for it. However, there is a problem with that in and of itself, in that if there is a specific
conformity, should we say?
Well, that wasn't actually what I was going to talk about, but that's still true.
Yeah.
But there is, if there is something inherent to human nature that predisposes people to a certain direction or conclusion, then it doesn't matter which academics carry out the research.
If the same all got bias, the same biases.
Exactly. There are lots of problems here, but the conformity aspect, I think, actually is more related to scientists trying to further their own careers. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, because we can take a much deeper dive into the mechanics of how that works, because it's not like scientists can just say, okay, well, I want to suck up to these specific people, and then they fake all of their research to do so.
Hang on, no, that's being too uncharitable. It's not about faking. It's about just the... Each person is within a kind of web of social interactions. Mm-hmm. And so if, for example, you're in an institution that's excessively woke, you can't really do research on IQ or something like that, for example. And so you are forced into these channels. And this is where Thomas Kuhn, I think, really has a valid point, where it's like, look, eventually a paradigm will be overturned, even though everyone agrees with the paradigm, because of the one or two... dissidents who end up proving a point that is true, and the evidence has to accumulate on that side, even if it's unpopular. And so the fact that scientists are human beings is, again, it's a really large barrier to doing science.
Yeah, because we have an inherent subjectivity to how we approach the world. And so when you're trying to be perfectly objective, It's very difficult.
It's just not possible, really.
No. And because it's impossible, it doesn't mean you shouldn't try, though, necessarily. Mm. I've always done my best to be as objective as possible, but tried to be humble enough not to delude myself that I ever am.
Yeah.
I think that that's the sweet spot. And I think that it's only been in the past 20 years or so that this philosophy of science has become commonplace to be taught. It was certainly what I was taught while I was at university. So I went in there thinking, well, we find out the truth, almost with a capital T, as in. And then I was slowly weaned out of that notion, this perhaps more colloquial notion, one that we certainly saw throughout the pandemic, whereby people think that once one research paper has been published that established something, then that must be true, because they don't understand the mechanics of how science actually works.
Yeah, it turns out there are, in fact, many truths of different gradients of truth. Some things are true sometimes under certain conditions, sometimes, you know, not. So
I think one of the best ways to approach it from a more psychological or philosophical point of view is having a hierarchy of certainty, because I don't think anyone should be completely certain about anything, but I think that doesn't mean you can't evaluate how truthful a certain claim is. Like, I could say, for example, I don't know, fairies are real, or I ate cereal yesterday.
May not have eaten cereal yesterday.
I know, but one of those claims is... but one of those claims is more likely to be true than the other, and that's okay to discriminate against one or the other. Yeah. And that's how it should be approached, in my
opinion. Everyone knows that Josh eats toast for breakfast, so.
I actually have cereal bars these days. But I do like toast. There's also the fact that many scientists get their research funding from private companies, and this is even the case in academic institutions, because although an academic may belong to a university, they still get funding from outside entities, quite often private companies. Like, I know that tobacco and industries like that have funded research that have tried to defame other things with a specific agenda. And although there are ethical guidelines that mean that you've got to declare who funds your research very explicitly, so whenever it's published, scientists will know to look for that data, particularly if they're in areas like pharmaceuticals, where there is an incentive for people to have a specific proclivity to certain answers that might not necessarily
come to
be truthful.
Conclusions that are profitable to the company that is funding the research.
Yes. Yeah. And obviously we're living in the consequences of such a system. So I think many people are well acquainted with the negatives in that way. So obviously there's also an incentive for academics to have a good relationship with the company that are providing them funding, because if they don't maintain a good relationship, it might harm either their academic reputation, their ability to get funding from the company in the future. And of course, one thing that people forget as well is that lots of companies that are hiring these academics, particularly pretty prolific ones, they don't exist in a vacuum. Mm. Quite often, the people who are running the businesses communicate with other business owners about the work they're doing. Yeah. And therefore, they can say, well, we hired this scientist to carry out some research, and actually they were a thorn in our side. We wasted lots of money. And that's the kind of thing that someone will tell to another business owner, which could harm that specific academic's chances of having a career in the first place. So you've got to keep people on your good side, even though that academic could have been doing all the right things. They could have just been describing the truth.
They may have come to exactly the correct conclusion through whatever methodology they were using. But also, they could well have just kind of intentionally fudged it a bit to make sure that they were keeping people happy.
Yes, so, yeah. And I think that this doesn't even need to be deliberate necessarily.
No.
I think that people are naturally predisposed to not bite the hand that feeds them.
Yep.
I think that's fair
totally
enough.
Fair. This brings me back to the point I made earlier, doesn't it? Which is, science has got very, very lofty claims for itself, and none of these claims can be fulfilled because it's being done by humans.
Mm-hmm.
Humans live in the world,
yes,
and in society.
Mm-hmm. One sort of caveat I think that is worth introducing to make it seem a little bit less bad is that many academics are aware of the influence that having a certain company looming over your head has. And so they tend to pick research projects that are more in line with their passions, because it is worth saying that you don't go into research and academia for money, because you can get far more elsewhere. Quite often it's people who are going into it out of a passion for the subject in and of itself, because if they were in it for fame and glory and money, then they would go into private sector stuff, into industry. And this is something that loads and loads of academics actually encouraged me to do, because I was going to train to be a university professor, and all of my professors were just like, no, don't do that, that's stupid. And when it's coming from them, I kind of thought, well,
I mean, they know, don't they? You know?
Yeah, I'm not going to question them, because they're very smart people that have done it themselves.
Okay.
But they were saying, yes, you'd have a lot more fulfillment and a lot more freedom if you actually went into the private sector, which in and of itself could be a bit of a problem, because then you don't have the research projects. I know that I'm going to be complementing a university, so brace yourselves, but you're not going to be doing research projects that necessarily have some sort of private interest at heart, because some academics do get funding from the universities to carry out research that is purely academic and in their interest. And these studies tend to be more beneficial, generally speaking. This is just my own value judgment. Obviously, they can be brutally ideologically
subversive.
Possessed. Yes. Yeah. But at least my experience of the field of psychology, particularly things like the cognitive side of things, they are so passionate about their subject that it's more things like, I want to understand this idiosyncrasy of visual perception or something like that, it's very difficult for it to be ideological.
It's something you can't really find a commercial justification for either.
Yes. I mean, there are business interests in lots of things. Like when I was at university, virtual reality was becoming a thing. And so these virtual reality companies were funding lots of research into visual perception because they wanted to understand how can we build the best product. But I don't necessarily think that's bad, because it's just trying to understand the nature of human perception to cater something better to those proclivities rather than...
Another issue is that you don't actually know what you're going to find when you're doing these research projects. Like a lot of... There's work into, what is it, like... I read a thing about it the other day. I can't remember the discipline of science, but it's like something to do with space. But it's got no application. It's got absolutely no application. Mm-hmm. We can't use it in any way, shape, or form. But it does reveal things that have applications that you can't predict as kind of side effects of this. And so it tends to be worth doing research into things, even though you can't really commercially justify it. Because, you know, you might be like, right, I'm going to look into, you know, whatever particular weird, strange, obscure subject. And then something that seems totally unconnected will pick that up and say, oh, actually, this is like a thing we can use. And you're like, okay, but you would never have linked those two things mm-hmm. before doing the research, you know, because you didn't know what you're going to find. You didn't know they would have a use for it.
That's absolutely true. And that's why I quite often defend research projects that seem other people.
Kooky, right?
Yeah. Like I saw one where I think it was members of Congress were complaining about funding research into the fruit fly, but actually the fruit fly is used in loads of different biological experiments because they're really quick to reproduce and therefore they're very useful to scientists. So understanding the nature of something that's used so commonly in science is actually very useful, but to someone who doesn't necessarily know the inner workings of the scientific method, like members of Congress, then it seems like a frivolous waste of money.
Yeah.
But, you're absolutely right to say that when you're working from a position where you don't know the direction in which the truth is, it makes sense to research things for their own sake. Because, of course, you don't know what the linchpin to developing a new understanding of something is going to be.
You don't know what you'll unlock.
And I've always found, this is why I've always had really, really broad interests, you don't know the kind of theory that's going to be the thing that gives you that eureka moment. Like I apply lessons I've learned from learning music theory to my philosophy of science. You never would think that those two things have any overlap whatsoever, but they do, and it's quite surprising. And actually learning from lots of different disciplines or different areas or different sub-disciplines of the same overarching one is a very useful way of looking at the world from a different paradigm. And it gives you a bit more perspective on what you're trying to do, because I think this is just a tendency of human nature that when you focus on a specific thing, you entrench thought patterns that are very difficult to break out of. And even at a neuroscientific level, it's good to think of it as perhaps walking on paths in a field. In that the more you walk down a path, the more it's indented into the field itself.
The more comfortable it is to continue walking down that path.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's how it even works at a neural level, in that well-trodden neural pathways are easier to navigate. That's why you have the notion of a difficult truth.
Yeah.
In that you're trying to basically re-engineer new neural pathways. If I'm looking at it from the neuroscientist's perspective. So it's not necessarily an easy thing to do, although we are able to do it as long as you have the correct approach to that. So this is something, again, that seems rather poignant, that data can be fabricated or manipulated to pretty much say whatever you want it to if you have biased intentions. And you can just make up results. This does happen. Like Andrew Wakefield in 1998 suggested a link between MMR and autism. And this ended up in lots of people avoiding getting the MMR vaccine, which I have, and I don't have autism, although I'm sure the comments will debate that. But yes, and he stood to benefit financially to, I think, the tune of 43 million selling testing kits. So he had a financial incentive to lie about the results. And he admitted eventually to just making them up. I'm sure there's going to be someone just like, yes, well, he's still right.
Yeah,
in
that's
the comments.
I got the MMR vaccine and then I got autism.
But yeah, he deliberately made up the link between that to gain something. But this is relatively rare because it's easy to spot, although he did seem to get away with it a little bit. There are academics that have been in institutions for, say, 40 years, and then it emerges that all of their research was made up, or they carried out bad practices.
Was something about this that came out the other day.
It does happen every now and then.
Wasn't it like dementia or Alzheimer's or something? This guy had
I didn't actually hear about that. Normally, I'm quite plugged into that world.
Sorry, I wish I'd got the resources together, because I didn't realize it was going to come up. I should have thought that that was going to come up, actually. I'm sure there was something about like Alzheimer's research that had just been a massive waste of money because it was just nonsense. We'll have to fact check me on that.
Well, it certainly happens, and it is a flaw. But normally this isn't the most insidious problem because it's relatively rare, because not only do academics understand that it's not a very good strategy to build a career in that you will get caught eventually because
people are checking your work.
Yeah, people are too pedantic. And I think he got too much public notoriety was the problem, that it was sort of front page news that there was this link, and therefore there were lots of eyeballs on his research. Mm. And I think people can get away with it if they're more small time. And
yeah, if they're not
under any scrutiny.
Yeah, I'm
really.
Just going to Google this.
Okay, sure.
You carry on.
But yes, another aspect of it is that you can just, this is a more honest thing that many experimenters are guilty of to some extent. You can do multiple experiments until you get the result that you want. So the way that a lot of statistical testing works is that you test to a statistical level of certainty of about, I don't know, a 5% chance that the results were a product of random chance. This is normally known as a p-value, which is just to represent...
Yeah, where one is absolute certainty, isn't
it? Yes. Yeah. So that's still...
Sorry, just to... Right, so yeah, on science.org, I knew I'd seen something like this. So a neuroscience image sleuth finds signs of fabrication in scores of Alzheimer's articles threatening a reigning theory of the disease. I knew I'd seen something. This was July or June last year, where essentially it turns out that massive amounts of research into Alzheimer's was actually fraudulent and wasted.
So, I didn't know about that.
So it's really set the field of study back, as I understand it.
That's quite frustrating as well.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't know about that, actually.
I know.
You thought that would have come up.
Perhaps it was... perhaps it wasn't just a large swath of the research, but a specific perspective in it.
I'd have to go into it. But, yeah. Like, I did see the headlines going around. I saw like a few summaries. And I was like, God.
Well, I have to look into that. Really,
it's not my field of expertise. So I was just like, well.
I'm not necessarily a clinical psychologist myself.
But that was just another tick in the box of anti-science.
But back to the multiple experiment thing. So the way it works is because... they're testing with a pretty high level of certainty that it isn't a product of random chance. So the way statistical testing works for the people at home is that you run a test to establish mathematically how likely the data you have, the amount of variations in the data, that sort of thing, could be a product of chance. The stronger the trend, the more likely it's describing something real and in the world, and therefore the more certain you can be that it isn't a product of random chance. And this will be represented in the p-value. But if you, say, have something that is about close to the threshold where it's a 5% chance, then you can run the experiment 20 times, and then as long as you're not unlucky, you're going to get one experiment that is the exception to the actual rule. And this is something that academics have been caught out with, is that they've run experiments multiple times and then cherry-picked the one that they wanted to report on to support a specific theory. And generally speaking, journals are getting a bit more hot on this sort of thing because they understand that this isn't actually proper science. Because
it's the opposite, actually, science.
It is purely ideological, but it's masquerading as being science. But that's perhaps only slightly less malevolent, but there are ways in which you can bias things just through your presumptions about the world. So I think one of the most prevalent is the recruitment bias or a sampling bias, whereby you can...
We call this the YouGov effect.
But... there are certain avenues for participant recruitment that may give you a biased selection of participants. And you can dress this up as being, you know, this is a representative sample. I've got lots of people of different ages, from different countries, different ethnicities, but then they all have a shared belief about something. And this
This is something that's endemic to feminist research. It is. Trying to find out what percentage of women have been sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And so when it turns out to be like 1 in 4, 1 in 3, and then you go and there was a famous survey that was done that found that something like 1 in 4 women had been sexually assaulted on college campuses.
I've read through that entire paper many times.
But the authors of it had to put out a statement saying that's not what this says, because of the self-selection bias, as in we did it online and there was a natural proclivity for people who had been sexually assaulted to fill out the survey. And of course, people who hadn't been sexually assaulted, I'm just going to ignore it because it's self-selected. They've got no interest in talking about it. Whereas someone who is a victim of that is interested in talking about it.
Absolutely. So
it was a totally false conclusion that the feminists were drawing from it.
And I think that this is something, again, that lots of people in the sciences are made aware of, particularly when studying humans, is that, yes, their motivation for participating in your study tends to be very much shaping of their responses. Mm. And you've got to be able to acknowledge and figure out ways in which that can either be mitigated against or at least mention it as something to take with a massive pinch of salt when you actually give your results. And what I did with my research was that when I was studying decision making, I knew that I would be recruiting a sample of students at a university, which generally speaking doesn't have that much ecological validity or generalizability to the wider population because it's a very select group of people. But I shaped my experiment to have decision making scenarios about choosing between different universities that have different criteria in their sort of pros and cons. And that way I designed my experiment around the participants that I knew I would be recruiting from in an area in which they actually have direct experience of. And then I used that as an example of, okay, well, here are people making decisions with something that they have direct on-hand experience where people would actually approach them and ask them for advice. They would see them as someone who's gone through this, and therefore this is a more valid approach because you've catered the design of the experiment to the population you're recruiting from. And I think that that's a good way to mitigate against biases, but of course it depends on the nature of the experiment and it's very difficult, and you've also got to be aware
of the person doing it as well. Like we were saying, it's I find this sort of thing very questionable, actually. So
in what sense?
I think the postmoderns have a point where it's like, look, the things that, as we were saying before, like the things that you notice are the things that inform your perception. Mm-hmm. And that comes from a particular paradigm anyway.
Yes.
And so essentially it's very difficult to break out of a paradigm and get something that isn't like objective, but is more incorporative of things outside of the paradigm, right? And then that's not even say about the bias of the subjects who come in to, you know, you do the experiment or you do the survey with or whatever it is. For example, like there are underlying value judgments that are incorporated into the criteria you choose to do the experiment with that you are loading with importance that might not have any importance at all, depending on what you're trying to do. And so this is just, I mean, we see this very clearly with left-wing postmodern progressives now, where they will put excessive concern on things like skin color or the concept of inequality, the concepts of like these things, these are the waters they swim in, and they might not understand that these aren't actually relevant to something that has happened. And so they always come out with a wrong-headed interpretation of what has happened, but they feel that it is exactly the correct interpretation. This is the kind of results they were expecting to see. It's what they were looking for, even if they thought they were doing everything objectively. So the very nature of human perception and value judgments colors what is being done.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I think you're right to refer to that as a postmodern idea, and I think actually...
it's one that I think they're not wrong on.
No, I think actually postmodernism, when applied to science, is a force for good at the minute.
It's got some good points, actually, I have to say.
I know it's a bit of a dirty belief system because we know how it integrates with wokeism, but it can be used...
If it's not for wokeism.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is... Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I agree.
But what was I going to say? Oh, yes. Of course, there are lots of cases as well of academics who've set out to research one thing from a specific perspective and then found the opposite and then gone on to publish it.
Yep.
So I'm not necessarily criticising the field in that respect. There are people with integrity and I know many of them personally, actually.
Well, so, that's good. But the danger lies in those people who... It's not even that they're being dishonest either.
Most of the problems with the actual bias-shaping research, I don't think it's actually deliberate, necessarily from the wokists who are ideologically possessed. They believe, they have a genuine conviction that their perspective is correct, because you don't sink that much time into something that's purely political and ideological. You don't...
It's cynical. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. I think there are a lot of them who have sincere convictions. They're just blind to the limitations of those.
Yeah, and I think that encouraging people to be more introspective about what they believe is just healthy, generally speaking, just outside of science. But it's,
humility is something that I find is lacking from these people.
Yeah, and I've always held that you can never truly know whether anything is truthful. Mm. You've just got to do the best you can and work with what you've got and try and weight things as being more truthful than others and have a working understanding of truth rather than some sort of objective academic one, I think.
Yeah. But the problem, again, it comes back to humans doing science, is that once you invest a lot of your time and self in any one project, you find yourself with an emotional commitment to it.
Yes.
And if it turns out that not only you were wrong and the opposite is true, it's one thing being wrong, but if it's actually the inverse of what you thought was correct, it's very difficult to bring yourself to admit that on a human level, just because of the investment and the ego attached to it. And things
because,
like
of
this.
Course, your scientific reputation is built on you coming across as being a good...
Competent.
Yeah, good, competent academic.
When in fact, the competence would be to admit, no, I was totally wrong about all of this, and in fact, the opposite of my theory and research were true.
This goes on... quite a lot, actually, and I'm very pleased about it. And I think it is just a consequence of people going into it because of a passion for the subject, and they actually really care about finding out the nature of it. Mm. And my experience of interacting with scientists is that the only reason they're still there is because they love their subject.
Right, okay.
And it's not for the money. It's certainly not to be part of the institution of a university, because most of them talk about it with utter contempt.
So do I.
Yeah. It might have been the time that I was going to university. This was when it was all the feminist stuff. So it was almost pre-woke. Mm. It was just captured by third wave feminism, which... looking back, seems quite tame to what we have now.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It's quaint, antiquated.
But moving now on to the publishing, which I think actually is where some of the worst problems are, in my opinion. So academic journals are obviously the things that publish scientific research. So a researcher would approach an academic journal saying, I've got this research. Would you please be able to publish it? And they can say yes or no, depending on how significant they think the research is and also how interesting it is to their readers. Mm. Like they're selling a product, these journals. And so they have an incentive, not necessarily to report on what is the most important in the subject, even though many of the academics would actually like that. But people still have a proclivity to read the study that's the most interesting.
Market forces still apply.
Yes, they do, unfortunately. If only Thomas were here. So these journals curate the impression that many academics get about the nature of their field, because they're selecting what they think is most interesting and what they think will sell the most journals. And this is just adding another level of bias, because, of course, you've got the academics that want to live up to the interest in their research. And then you've got the journals as well. And it's a multi-layer of bias that is...
It's vanity.
I think, Yes.
Vanity. Now it's about being accepted by your peers and having an impact in the wider scientific community and accruing fame and credit.
Mm-hmm. And I think that many of the people that go down that route don't necessarily realize they're doing it until it's a bit too late.
Yeah. Well, but, it's an incentive and people follow incentives unconsciously because, well, why wouldn't you?
I have heard from lots of academics that were particularly honest, saying when I first started out in my career, I was kind of chasing notoriety and fame. But as I actually got a bit more secure in my place in this ecosphere, I became more confident in going against the grain. And I think that that's something that happens when an academic matures, they're more likely to be disagreeable to the consensus in their field. And I think that that's just a product of both just being actually more secure, as well as when you get older, you're more comfortable being disagreeable.
Yeah.
So there's kind of two factors at work there. So I've talked about the exposure being selected. There's also something known as a positive result bias, in that it's equally as important to science to know what has an effect on the world as it is to know what doesn't. Those are equivalent things if we're talking purely objectively. But in terms of scientific publishing, it's far more interesting to have a positive result that says this thing has an effect on this thing, rather than saying, well, these two things have no effect on each other. It's not really...
It's quite easy to do that, probably, isn't it?
Yes. Well, obviously, if you're saying yes...
There are lots of things that don't have an effect on one another,
It still has to be somewhat relevant, but it's more that, and this is a term that is actually surprisingly commonly used, you don't have sexy results. You don't have results that are actually interesting and marketable, because saying, okay, I've just discovered this new thing about the world, that's far more appealing than saying, well, I've discovered that these two things don't have a connection.
But it would have to be something very important and very like a established wisdom for it to be important to say
that
this
tends
is not,
to be where these negative studies come about. Like you get one saying, like, there's no connection between the burning of fossil fuels and
climate change.
Yeah.
That would be a major thing that would probably get censored.
Well, there are research papers that say that. So it already exists.
But you just don't get to hear about them.
No.
Because things are agenda driven.
That's true. But I'm going to talk about how science gets disseminated into the general population later. But I find that people are a bit more savvy about that, whereas the inner workings of how it works, you've really got to have experienced it and be an insider to know all of these problems, as well as it's a lot to get your head around, and you have to probably be taught, because it's a lot of work to understand it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.